Cheryl, welcome. How are you today?
Thank you, Afa. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So will you tell us a little bit about your personal gardening as far as where and how did you first start gardening?
Well, that's a real interesting question, Ava. I grew up in Southern California where food came from grocery stores. And I was given a packet of seeds as a little girl, and of course nothing grew because I didn't water it. But when I was in high school, my boyfriend's father, who was from the South, wanted collard greens, couldn't find it, and did the most bizarre thing. He dug up part of his lawn and planted collards. And that to me was like, oh, we can really grow our own food. So over the years, that thought just, you know, that seed was planted in my mind. And when I moved to Montana, I had the good fortune of living next to some people who were growing food in their yard. It was very inspiring to me. And when I bought my first house, there was a large garden plot. And I had neighbors all around me who were doing vegetable gardening. They were my mentors, my saviors. And I have been gardening in the Gallatin Valley in Montana. I learned to garden in the Rocky Mountains, so I know the conditions. And I've been doing it for 30 years now. And I've had three different methods of gardening, all of them being very successful. Between my late husband and I, we had over 100 years of gardening experience, and we were primarily vegetable and fruit gardeners.
Wow, that's incredible, 100 years.
Yeah. Well, he used to garden with his grandfather, who raised him when he was a little boy, and he grew up knowing where food came from, and so it's been a very, very interesting road with him.
Yes, I bet. And Cheryl, you mentioned you've gone through three different methods. I'm curious if you could brief us on what you mean by that.
Well, I have right now I have a 1,000 square foot in-ground garden, so I'm gardening directly in the garden, which is it's a very traditional method. When I lived in town, I had a very small yard and I had raised beds, and I built them myself, constructed them myself, maintained them myself, and I love raised beds. And then when I was with Montana State University, we had some hoop houses that we gardened in. I've worked in greenhouses on the campus, full-scale professional greenhouses. So quite a wide variety of experiences.
Yes, I'd say. And the one that you use now, you described as in-garden, and so that's kind of where you've rested at and what you're preferring.
It's in-ground, which means I'm gardening directly in the ground as opposed to with raised beds or anything like that. And it was more of a convenience to me. When we bought this house, we had the 1,000-square-foot garden out in the backyard, and I just didn't really want to take the time to build raised beds, although if I had it to do it again, I would, because I love raised beds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So let's talk about zones, shall we?
Sure.
So the first thing, I put out an email to remind people about the call today, and I put a little line in the subject line that I thought might catch people's attention, which is that some people think of USDA hardiness zones as controversial. And I wonder if you can expand on that idea a little bit, why it might be considered so.
Well, you know, Ava, I have to say that I don't view it personally as being controversial. I think that the system is quite limited, however, and that a number of gardeners, especially new gardeners, want to depend too heavily upon the USDA hardiness zones. It's quite limited.
Mm-hmm. And can you speak to some of the limitations or shortcomings that it has?
Sure. The USDA hardiness zone speaks only to the average minimum temperatures found in any given location. It says nothing whatsoever about wind, soil type, moisture, humidity, season length. The zone has nothing to do with your season length, how plants are planted in the garden. it just speaks to the average minimum temperatures. And if you are gardening with annuals, in other words, if you have lots of flowers or vegetables, it doesn't matter because it has nothing to do with your season length. It's just the coldness in the winter. When you want to pay attention to the USDA hardiness zone, you want to be thinking about perennials, those plants that come back for at least 3 years, biennials that overwinter and come back and flower the second year, and trees and shrubs.
Okay. Great. And then it looks like some people consider that other things affecting plant growth that are not considered in the USDA hardiness zones include pollution and the amount of snow that accumulates in a certain place, and winter sun that can be very intense. I know that, for example, we here, where I live in southwestern Colorado, is the same zone as where I grew up, actually, in Ohio, and the climate seems so entirely different to me as a human experiencing them that I would only imagine that they would also be experienced very differently by the plants that grow in them. And I know for a fact there are many plants that will grow in one of those places and not the other, even though the zone is considered the same.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that the USDA hardiness zone in much of Maine is the same as Montana. And you can imagine with the acidic soils of Maine and the alkaline soils, say, in Montana, we can grow very, very different plants. The duration of the exposure to cold is a huge thing because some plants can take just a short couple of days of cold, while others can take a longer period of that cold weather. Humidity is also a huge deal. People come to our location in Montana and they want to grow blueberries because it's the same USDA hardiness zone. But we don't have the humidity that they have in Maine. Our sunshine is more intense than in Maine. The pH of the soil is completely different. And my late husband was the blueberry expert in Maine and wrote the book on growing blueberries. And he tried very hard to grow blueberries here. And while he could get them to survive, they wouldn't thrive, even if he put sulfuric acid on the soil.
Wow, so does that probably then equate in very little to no fruiting?
Yes, yeah. You may buy blueberry bushes and they may fruit the first year here in our alkaline soils, but that's because those fruit or flower blossoms were formed in the nice cozy greenhouse the year before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, interesting. Good thing to remember. I know when I worked at a nursery my first summer in Colorado, people would come in fairly regularly asking about blueberry plants specifically, and it was hard to crush their dreams and tell them they just weren't going to work very well.
That's right, and it's interesting, too, that there are little pockets in the Rocky Mountain region where you can grow blueberries successfully. It's just, generally speaking, for the average Joe gardener, it's not going to be a real easy thing to do. Of course, you can throw all the money at it that you want, and the more money you throw at the project, the more successful you're likely to be. But why not grow something that's really adapted here, like strawberries or raspberries?
Exactly. Sounds like it makes sense to me. That's one of the things that I'm hoping to help people understand with this whole series is why struggle when you could learn to work with the environment that we have and have a much easier time of it and still have time to enjoy your children or grandchildren or hike with your dog or whatever you like to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the ways to have a successful garden here is to understand the limitations of your location. And now that can also include what we call microclimates.
Mm-hmm.
Within a given landscape, within a given neighborhood, you may be in USDA hardiness zone 4, but the north part of your house or the north of your house is going to be colder. The south part of your house or the landscape on the south part is going to be warmer. You may have pockets of low elevation where you have frost pockets. And sometimes you have higher elevations that have a little bit warmer. So you've got to know what's going on in your yard and work with it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's great advice. And I think that an exciting side of that is that you can really grow a much greater diversity of plants by paying attention to those.
Absolutely.
And so can you actually give us some just some real practical information about how to make use of that concept? Like, would you put outdoor thermometers in different places around your space that you think might vary quite a bit as far as low temperatures? Or how do you go about gauging that so that you can really make use of those microclimates?
I would absolutely invest in a soil thermometer, and that's useful throughout your garden. Also, high-low thermometers that record the 24-hour or when the last time you set it. Temperatures on the north-south, maybe there's a place where you could borrow one or a group of people get together, because you probably don't need them for more than, you know, a year or so to get good readings on that. Know what your soil is like. My soil is very silty. Other parts of the canyon, we have very clayish soils. So knowing exactly what's going on in your location, the length of your growing season is really important. Know what your winter lows and your summer highs are. And also, take a walk around your neighborhood and be observant. I mean, if you live in a neighborhood, not out in the country, and see what people are growing successfully on the north side of their house, the south side of their house. Make notes, and then plan accordingly in your own yard.
Yeah, I think that makes great sense. And actually, as a garden designer, I have met with many clients who really don't know what they want to plant around their yard, and I've given them very similar advice as far as use the resource that your neighborhood is. Walk around. Even with digital photography on accessible by telephones now, it's just so easy to snap photos. So I encourage people to snap photos of plants that look like they're really thriving within their same neighborhood, and you can make a kind of a photo collage of those on your computer to really hone in on what does well right where you're at and what looks good and what you really like, to compile your own collage, your living collage around your own garden. So I think
that's right, because then you're depending on the experience of your neighbors, and I think that the no hardiness zone map can really take the place of the knowledge of your neighbors and gardeners that are already there. Like I said, when I started vegetable gardening, I had vegetable gardeners all around me, and that was invaluable.
Mm-hmm. I bet. Yeah. So then let's talk about what the USDA has recently done as far as addressing hardiness zones and the changes that they've made. And so this is a time, just to let everyone know, in case you weren't on the call yet when I was doing the orientation to the series, you were sent an email with some links in it that will be helpful for today's talk. And so if you're able to access that link, it'll take you to the page. It's the address is planthardiness.ars.usda.gov, and you'll be able to see what we're talking about, which will be really helpful. So, Cheryl, what do you have to say about what changes have been made recently?
Well, the original USDA hardiness zone came out in 1960, and of course we didn't have the internet there then, and it was updated in 1990, but this new update has been developed specifically for internet use. It's interactive, and you can put your zip code into their search engine, and it will tell you what your current USDA hardiness zone is. Now, for those people who may not know, USDA hardiness zones are in 10-degree increments, and within those 10-degree increments, they have 5-degree increments with A and B designation, which are pretty specific. But like we were saying a minute ago, you still need to know what's going on in your yard and know what all those microclimates are, where you might have a warmer area or a smaller area. The new USDA hardiness zone has more data points in it. than the previous 1990. And those of you who know scientific statistics and so on, the more data points you have, the more accurate the results are going to be. So even if your zone is now listed as slightly different than it was before, it doesn't mean you have to run out and pull up all your perennials or specifically plant only new ones for this new zone. Chances are really good that if something in your yard has been thriving, it's going to continue to thrive even if you do have an A designation instead of a B designation now.
Great. That's really helpful clarification. And then mountainous regions, how are they? How do you work with zones in the mountains, and how much do they change as you go up in elevation and lower in elevation?
Well, of course, the mountainous ranges are going to be cooler rather than warmer. There's a warm band down below the upper parts of the mountains. And so, interestingly enough, whereas a lot of the data points for the new USDA hardiness zones indicate a slight warming of most of many of the data points, those in the mountainous regions have actually are actually showing cooler.
Oh, really? That's interesting. And so when people, well, do you think the map, the new one, is able to accurately represent the elevation differences when many of us live in such mountainous regions? You know, you go up 500 feet up the valley or whatever, and is all that captured with one zip code that you might enter into the website?
No, I kind of don't think so. Again, you have to go into your microclimates, and the USDA hardiness zone map can only be as accurate as the location of its data points. And so if it is concentrating down in the lower elevations more than the upper elevations, and we're talking mountaintops here. We're not talking 4,900 feet, which is where I am in Bozeman. I think that you know, they are going to be limited for some regions as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. And then just to bring this all home for any newer gardeners that we have on the line or maybe who just haven't paid that much attention to zones, what's relevant about zones for the average gardener? How are they applicable and how do they actually put them into usage?
Okay. First of all, you're going to find out what your USDA hardiness zone is. If you are shopping for perennials like herbaceous perennials, which die to the ground, or woody perennials like shrubs and bushes or biennials. And then you're going to find out what your season length is so that we know that the plant will thrive in the amount of growing season that you have, and that is not in the USDA hardiness zone. Then what you want to do is go down to the local nursery, and they should have their plants rated according to the USDA hardiness zones. And don't purchase something, unless you're experimenting, that is a higher USDA hardiness zone than where you live. In fact, many people prefer to select plants that have one USDA hardiness zone lower than where they live. So in a zone 4 situation, you might get a zone 5 plant. And I said that backwards, a higher zone, not a lower zone.
So will you say that again?
Okay. Sorry. I got goofed up. Some people like to push the zone and plant plants that do not thrive in the cool temperatures of their current zone. And so if you do that, just be aware. What we like you to do is to purchase plants that are going to be a little more hardy than your current zone is. So if you're in a zone 4, buy a zone 3 plant because it's going to have more hardiness.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Yes, I live at 6,500 feet, and I'm pretty much on the cusp, actually, of zone 4 and zone 5, at least according to the old map. Now I'm probably entirely in zone 5, but the whole idea of planting one zone colder, which is one number lower in zone, will make it safer as far as my plant
right.
surviving. Yeah, so just to reiterate that with another example to try to clarify. So one thing that I think often throws people off is that as the elevation numbers go higher, the zone numbers go lower. So it's like an inverse relationship there.
But the USDA people themselves do not say that. That's just an observation.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay.
They on their website, they admit that the only thing it covers is the average minimum temperature.
Okay. They don't try to tie it to elevation, in other words.
No, they don't, huh?
Okay. Well, I find it useful to think of that way because I, you know, I live not very far away from 14,000 foot peaks and and here at about, well, less than half that amount, it definitely comes into play. You need something we need to think about and relate to. In fact, when you walk into a local nursery, oftentimes if you ask for some plant help, the first thing you'll be asked is, well, what elevation do you live at? And I definitely see it coming into play on a regular basis. So if the USDA won't say that, I will lend you that bit of advice.
Sure.
Okay. And then we talked at the beginning about the shortcomings that this system has. Do you know, Cheryl, if there is a better system, maybe in a different country perhaps, or what do people in other parts of the world use?
Well, you know, I have been very interested in that. I have friends that live throughout the world, and I find it very interesting that they have pretty much based their hardiness zones on the USDA model. And so they use pretty much the same temperatures, the same numerical designations. Of course, there's some countries where they won't be using all of the numbers that we use, like warm areas such as Australia and Africa, where they're up in the higher digits and very, very few lower digits. In fact, I think I remember reading that in Australia, for instance, they only have 4 hardiness zones there.
Wow. And they're comparable to the USDA hardiness zones.
Yes.
Wow.
Yep, they are.
That's something to get my mind around that there would only be 4. I'm just
yes.
kind of sitting with that right now.
Well, it's also something that I'd like to mention with the USDA hardiness zone. This version has added 2 very hot hardiness zones, probably modeling Africa and Australia. We now have zones 12, which has an average minimum temperature of 50, and zone 13 with average minimum temperatures of 60. These are only found in Hawaii and Puerto Rico. And why that's important to us is that we have a lot of tropical houseplants that a number of us like to put out on the porch during the summer to enjoy while we're having our barbecues. And if you know what the hardiness rating of these houseplants are, you'll know when it's safe to put them out and when you need to bring them in for the benefit of the plant.
That's a really good point. That would be helpful to know because I have often wondered that myself. How do I
yep.
know when they're okay out there? Because I know so many people do like to move their plants outside in the summer, and I'm always a little scared about it.
Yep.
So, yeah, that will be helpful. And that also, well, I wonder, I know a lot of houseplants can't take direct sunlight, and back quite a while ago now, thank goodness, I actually fried a lot of little baby spider plants that I had newly transplanted, thinking I was giving them some really great bonus by putting them out in the sun. And that was even on the coast, way down low at sea level elevation, and they still fried. So I think it's important to look at heat as far as how that relates to plant growth and health as well. And instead of talking about the house plants, let's talk about it with garden plants again and the AHS heat zone map.
Okay. The American Horticultural Society has come up with a heat zone map, which rather like the USDA hardiness zone map, instead of the average cold temperatures, the AHS heat zone map tells how many days in a year certain locations have temperatures over 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, again, this is an average. The reason they chose 86 degrees Fahrenheit is that this is the temperature at which plants begin suffering physiological damage from heat. Now, one of the reasons this is important is that while cold temperatures can kill a plant pretty fast, too many heat days can kill a plant very, very slowly. And you may just watch your plant starting to decline. The flower buds will wither. You may have leaves that become more attractive to insects because the chlorophyll is disappearing. The leaves may cease growing. And so the death from heat is pretty slow, and it actually can happen over a number of years. So what you're going to be seeing in garden centers and in magazines as a rating, you're used to seeing the USDA hardiness zones as, for instance, tulips, zones 3 through 8, and that's the USDA hardiness zone. You may see a second set of numbers, like for tulips, 8 through 1. And so what this means is the AHS heat zone map 1 means that it has one day of temperatures above 86 degrees Fahrenheit, and zone 8 in the AHS system says 120. So you know that if you live in USDA zone 7 and AHS zone 7, you can leave tulips outdoors in your garden year-round. Now, did you want to mention the map location for this?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Cheryl. The link to the map for this heat zone map also was emailed to excuse me, to all of you who are listening out there. And it's kind of a long address, but I'll read it just in case it's helpful to anyone. It's www.ahs.org/pdfs/05_heat, H-E-A-T, underscore map, M-A-P, dot PDF. So hopefully that will be helpful. If you can find that email we sent with a link in it, that's going to be your easier bet. But, yeah, that's an interesting system that I have not been familiar with, Cheryl, so I'm glad that you brought that to the table. And it's interesting to me to hear that that will probably come into more common usage. Is that because it's becoming more relevant as things warm up, evidenced by the revamping of the whole hardiness zones, or is it more just that it's a new system and it hasn't really gotten into common usage yet?
It's a relatively new system, and it has not been accepted as a nationwide standard, but the AHS, the American Horticultural Society, is a professional society of horticulturalists. Excuse me, my husband would kill me over that one, horticulturists. And so it seems to me to be a very useful tool that we can put in our tool bag. With this heat zone knowledge, we are able to code annuals, including flowers, vegetables, herbs. We'll be doing crop plants, as well as biennials and perennials.
Wow, it sounds really useful. I'm looking forward to seeing that on some plant labels coming up before
long. Yes.
Great. And Cheryl, what about sunset garden zones? What do you think about those? I know when I lived in California before I moved here to Colorado, they were used all the time and they were really helpful. And I got here and all of a sudden no one really talked about them anymore. And every now and then I do hear someone mentioning them and I kind of think, uh-oh, I don't know if that's going to work for them here. So what do you think about them?
Well, The sunset zones, I think that they have their place, and it is really a wonderful concept because not only does it include the length of your growing season, but also the timing of rainfall, the amount of it, winter lows, summer highs, and humidity. So you'd think that this would be a really, really accurate, wonderful tool for the entire United States. Now, I think that it also, however, is limited. For example, in Montana, we have 7 different USDA hardiness zones. And last time I checked on the sunset zone map, all of Montana was in zone 1. Now, that's not helpful, and it's not reality, because the western part of our state is the Rocky Mountains, and the eastern part of our state is the Upper Great Plains. When I went on to the sunset map page yesterday, I actually couldn't even find Montana on there. So I would be very interested in knowing from you, Ava, how it was helpful for you when you were using it.
Well, I'll tell you the main reason it was helpful was because no one talked about USDA zones there, not at all. In my experience, everyone just really relied on the sunset zones because they were so helpful, and I'm quite sure they were devised in California, but they are helpful all the way up the coast with those similar climates on the whole West Coast, and they just worked really well, and they were much more detailed for that region. But similar to what you said about Montana, I think last time I checked, Colorado was divided into maybe 2 zones. I want to say it was maybe there was like 1B and 2A or something, but it was just very limited and not at all helpful or instructive. And it all correlates with the, let's see, I have it right here, Sunset Western Garden book. Yep, that's what it's called, that I don't use very much anymore because it does all relate back to those sunset zones, although it's unfortunate in my mind because the book is pretty amazing and it really is a staple and a Bible, I would even call it, of horticulture on the West Coast and in California. And I haven't
absolutely. One of the things when I started gardening, in all sincerity, here in Montana, I bought all of the gardening books that I could find, and I did buy the sunset book, and it was very, very good information for me, but it wasn't all very applicable to living in the mountainous states, which it was frustrating for me as a beginner, which was also why my husband and I wrote the Guide to Rocky Mountain Vegetable Gardening, because it specifically addresses our states.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for that resource. It's exciting to have something that we know will work here for us as a great resource. That's terrific. So then, are there other things that our listeners and our gardeners should know here in the West to help us grow in these conditions that sometimes are perceived as challenging?
Well, I would say pay attention. And if you are in a new home and a new gardener, I would say wait one season and see what you have, especially if you happen to purchase your home in the wintertime. You don't know what's going to grow up and what's going to thrive. One of my big mistakes when I moved into a house was pulling a bunch of weeds that were growing next to the house that turned out to be a beautiful bed of rudbeckias. And it was just that I had not let my landscape tell me what would grow there very well before I started yanking things out. I would say get your soil tested, especially if you're going to be doing a vegetable garden. That's very important for your vegetables, and get it done professionally once, maybe every 3 years. Select your varieties carefully. Know where to go for help. And I think that that's one of the biggest things that people don't know. When I got to Montana, I heard of this very unusual organization called Extension. And coming from Southern California, very populated area, I had no idea what Extension was. And this is an organization at land-grant universities that give you free information for your location, They usually have downloadable information guides that can help you get started in pretty much any way in your gardens. There are also there is a wonderful magazine that is available that simply addresses our special needs in the Rocky Mountain region called Zone 4 Magazine, and it's a wonderful resource. And it's been going for several years, I think 3 or 4 years, and it's great.
Great. Well, I want to hear more about that in just a second, but I did want to comment on your encouragement of folks to wait a season before planting a garden or making major changes in a new space that they might have. I wonder what season means to you, because I have actually heard to wait a full year, because then you also get to see drainage patterns and where the snow load is and how big that really is and all kinds of factors like that that also tie in.
Yes, and perhaps a full year would have been a better way to state what I meant. So you're right on with that, Ava. Wait a full year, because you want to know your yard in every season before you get going changing things.
Yeah, it's sometimes so hard because you just want to get out there and start turning it into the beauty you really envision for it. But I think people do get much better results if they can hold back at least somewhat.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. I would strongly suggest it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that there unfortunately may be some people out there who are not yet familiar with Zone 4 magazine, and I would love to introduce it to them through you. I know the tagline is "Living in the High Country West." So I wonder what themes it encompasses, and how will gardeners specifically benefit from its content?
Well, it's different in the Rocky Mountain region. Gardening is different, living is different, and Zone 4 magazine specifically addresses that. We offer expert gardening advice, scientifically sound, to help people be more successful, and we cover pretty much everything in a person's yard, including flowers, vegetables, trees, grasses, and shrubs. And we also address the factors that make things challenging here, including the minimal precipitation, high elevation, short season, poor soil, hail, rain, intense sun. Did I mention hail? So Zone 4 magazine is mainly focused on gardening, but it also includes local foods and destination stories about horticulturally interesting things to see, and fresh local food to eat while you're in any area. So, say if I live in Bozeman, Montana, which I do, and I decide I'm going to take a weekend trip to Boise, I know kind of what to look for while I'm there because I've read about it in Zone 4 magazine.
Yeah, that makes it more fun and exciting to know what to expect. I've seen some great articles in it that I would classify as kind of being a part of the slow food movement, where
yep.
And like locavore ideas, and I think that's really fun too, especially like you said, for if I am going to a different town in the West, what I can look forward to. That's fun.
And that's so, right. I used it myself. I went down to Cody to do a talk for a group of people down there, and I got out the Zone 4 magazine and said, oh, this is what I'm going to do while I'm here, because I was going to be there for a couple of days.
Great.
I should also mention that the magazine covers Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and eastern Utah. And it's not just for people who live within Zone 4 in these areas. We also focus on Zone 5 and Zone 3 because it's the Rocky Mountain region that we cover. It's just very unique.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, that was my next question I was going to ask you, is what all it did cover. And why Zone 4? Why did, I assume it was Dan and Audra, why did they decide to call it Zone 4 instead of Zone 3 or Zone 5 perhaps? Do you know?
Well, interesting. There is a little interesting story about that. When they first got a hold of my late husband to help them initiate Zone 3 magazine, he said, well, I have some news for you. We're not in Zone 3. We're in Zone 4. and it's just, and it just took off from there. It's a catchy title. I really like it. And people who live in Zone 3 and Zone 5 also understand that the USDA hardiness zones are not what it's all about. It's tough gardening conditions and what we have to face together.
Very good. Yeah, I know. I really enjoy getting my edition in the mail every time it comes. It's something I really look forward to, and there's great photos too, and it's a wonderful resource. So to that end, we have collaborated to make it even more available to all of our listeners. If they would like to subscribe, they can either go to the website that you have a link for in your emails that you're getting from this teleseries, or you can go directly to zone4magazine.com and go to the store, and you'll get a discount on a subscription. Usually the subscription rate is $24, but if you use my first name, Ava, E-V-A, as in the little space that says, how did you hear of us, then you'll actually only be charged $20, although that won't be instantly reflected. It will happen down the line. You just have to trust that it will happen, but we assure you it will. And is that for 4 copies a year or 6?
Yes, it's quarterly.
Quarterly, okay. Thank you. So, yeah, I think that will be exciting for people. I hope you'll make use of that. And
you had a question from Boise.
We do, yeah. One other thing while we're talking about resources I was going to mention is that a couple of Cheryl's books, Guide to Rocky Mountain Vegetable Gardening and The Complete Guide to The Complete Guide to Saving Seeds, are both available also for easy access through my website, again, through that link that you get in your emails when we give you updates on which speaker is coming when and all of that. And they're in 2 different carousels. They're called those rotating little wheels of books. One's in one of them and one's in the other. And hopefully you'll enjoy reading Cheryl's book. I know she's an amazing resource. And, yeah, we would like to ask you one question, Cheryl, that was submitted by a listener, and her name is Mafi B, and she lives in Boise. And I'm just going to read it to you, and then you can tell me what you want to about it. Mafi says, I am a recent transplant from Florida to Boise, Idaho. Although the, quote, last frost date, unquote, is for an area is variable, in Florida, we knew that a certain date was the earliest that we should plant herbaceous perennials outdoors. Our local Fred Myers currently has a good inventory at a very reasonable price of herbaceous perennials, new plants in small pots. It would be very helpful if you could answer this question. What is the earliest date that one should plant herbaceous perennials outdoors in Boise, Idaho? Or where might I find that answer?
Okay, well, we get this kind of question from people who move to the Rocky Mountain region from warmer areas where they can pretty much grow anything they want to, and they throw away excess plant material. My sister calls it guerrilla gardening mm-hmm. because you have to go out there with a machete because everything grows so well. You're in for a bit of a change, Mafi. First of all, let me tell you that for Boise, I know that the average last frost date is May 8th. So if you go down there and purchase that plant material now, you're going to have to keep it inside and healthy until at least May 8th. Now, that's the average last frost date, so that's going to be plus or minus 2 weeks. The safe date to plant out perennials in Boise is May 26th. Now, just as a general sweeping statement, for those of you who may not know what your season length is, I'd suggest you get a hold of that rather interesting organization called Extension, and it will be housed at the land-grant university in your state, and they should have that information for you. I also have tables in the Guide to Rocky Mountain Vegetable Gardening on that kind of information as well. But Extension is a good place to go, especially if you're a transplant from a warmer area.
And just to bring all that we've been talking about home for people with Mafi's question, I think it's really helpful for that. What zone is she in there in Boise? Do you know offhand?
I don't know right offhand.
I know you were going to
sorry.
Look it up a little bit, and I'm just
we could put that into the USDA Hardiness Zone interactive map and find out.
We could. Yes, I'm wondering specifically. Let's say I think it's warmer than where I live. I'm going to guess that it's a zone 6, and let's say it is a zone 6 just for the moment. Does that mean that everyone that plugs in their zone on that website and finds out they're a zone 6, are they all going to be able to use that information you just gave Mafi about the last frost date?
Yes, because remember the USDA hardiness zone has nothing to do with the season length. It's only the average minimum temperatures.
Uh-huh. So everyone in zone 6 can pretty much expect that May 8th date and May 24th date to apply to them?
No, absolutely not. They only know that the average minimum temperature in Zone 6 is 10 below to zero. That does not have anything to do with the season length.
Okay, that's what I thought the answer was going to be, and then I thought you were saying the opposite, so I just wanted to clarify.
Oh, sorry. I might have gotten tangled up again.
No, it's okay. I'm just glad to clarify for everyone who's listening.
Sure. You bet.
And then you had a comment when I told you about Mafi's question the other day about experiences that friends of yours had who've worked at stores like Fred Meyer's or Home Depot, more big box type stores. Will you tell us about that?
Right. I usually like to encourage people to buy local whenever they can. Local nurseries have more input as to the plant material that they do carry. I have had friends and colleagues working in the garden center in big box stores. We'll just use it generically. And they get frustrated because their local manager doesn't have the say of what kind of plant material is sold by that store, and yet they're still expected to sell this plant material that may be less than appropriate for that region. So you might consider shopping around a little bit and seeing where the knowledgeable staff work.
Mm-hmm. So
it's not just about money. You know, you want a plant that's going to work, and you get what you pay for.
Mm-hmm. So Mafi might take advantage of the low prices at Fred Meyer's, and first she has to somehow house or protect those plants all the way until May 8th, or if she wants to be really safe, late into the month, and then perhaps she'll plant them outside at the right time and find out that they really weren't even plants that were meant for her area, or they aren't going to survive very well for her. Is that what it boils down to?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, sad but true. I think a lot of people face that kind of thing, and it can be disappointing for a lot of people. So it's a good thing to know and just be aware of and move forward with and really do your work. I mean, if you want to take advantage of those low prices every now and then, read a book like Cheryl's first and know what you're getting and know what's going to work before you spend a bunch of money because it seems like a great deal without really knowing about those plants.
Yep.
So with that, I want to thank you so much, Cheryl, for being with us today. I personally have learned quite a bit, and I hope that everyone else listening has too. I'm sure they have. I really appreciate your wealth and breadth of expertise. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, Eva.